Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Devin.
And we're back on a Thursday. We're updating our outlines, like, to the minute.
I know. We were literally typing away about a minute and a half ago.
Yeah. We did our interview today. Unveil who we talked to. So I'm kind of on a high from that because she was so awesome.
She was.
And so, but after that, we're like, so many things have changed. We have to update the outline.
I know.
So we took a little break to, you know, refocus, and update some things, because shit is moving at a mile a minute.
I know. It's really, you know, sometimes it's like, I'm glad that, you know, things are exciting, but I think that's just
don't go Susan Sarandon on me.
Right.
We're not energized here.
I was going to say, but I feel like that's just like me putting on my Pollyanna pants.
Yeah.
And being like, yeah, it's exciting at the very least.
I always say that I would binge watch the shit out of America 2017, but I don't want to live it.
I like that. It makes a great show.
And people who would write shows, if you brought this script to them, they'd be like, this is out of control. No. This would never happen. Yeah. You're like, well, let me tell you something. We have this fucking grifter as president. Mm-hmm. He's treating it like an entry-level job, and we're just letting him, apparently.
Right.
I mean, not us, but...
But, like, other people.
But it's a whole saga that even writers would be like, this is not real, but this is life.
Right.
And so, yeah, it is... It's invigorating to be armed with information.
Right.
And to channel that into, you know, healthy and productive things.
But, yeah, but I mean...
Preferably, we would not want to live this.
I'm probably enhancing it pretty hard. Yeah. It kind of reminds me of the Saturday Night Live... Or, not Saturday Night Live. It was a late night with Seth Meyers, and Amy Poehler was on, and they did... like a really segment the person who protested the Julius Caesar.
Oh yeah,
who looked like Trump. But
which play was it? Was it Caesar?
It was Caesar.
Some Shakespeare.
It was Shakespeare in the Park. It was Caesar, and someone protested when they tried to stab the guy who kind of looks like Trump. Whatever.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite parts was the segment is Seth Meyers was like, yeah, and it wasn't even accurate, because if it were accurate, the Senate wouldn't try to stab Trump. They would just pass his fucking healthcare bill.
Yes. It's so real.
And I was like, okay. Well, and, yeah. So true.
Anyway, we will get all into that.
We will.
But first, let's give an overview of what we will be discussing today. Mm-hmm. So as always, we like to start with listener feedback and then some updates on our end. Block two is our perma block, but we added a name to it.
We did.
So it's Trumpland/GOP/Man Bun Ken Bullshit. And if you don't know what we're talking about, just Google
buckle
it
up.
And it's a great meme. And buckle up. Yeah, so we'll be talking about the special election in Georgia and touching upon the special election in South Carolina as well. And then, of course, we'll be discussing the healthcare bill since it just got released.
Right.
And then we'll do a quick Russia update, because there's always a Russia update.
Always.
And then block three is our interview with the fantastic Brittany Packnett.
Oh, such a good interview.
She's amazing. You might recognize her from Pod Save the People. She's a board member of Rise to Run. Like, she's so amazing.
She's an educator.
She's an activist. We had a really great discussion with her. We think you friends will really love it. After that, we go into our gratitude check, which is always needed, as you know. Block five, we get into our Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. And then finally, we have some action items, so stuff you can do after you listen to the show. Okay, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback and updates. So what's the first thing we have today?
So we actually got some really amazing feedback on this one thing. So first of all, Jessica tweeted at us, quote, listening to today's Hellbent Pod, likely the podcast responsible for my 2,000% increase in swears. Hashtag feminist, hashtag resist and persist. I love that.
Yeah, that's our impact.
That's our impact. I'm into it. Tracy also said, quote, I always swore like a sailor, but now I say dickwad a lot. A lot. That's new.
Yeah. If there's one thing that we have contributed to the conversation, I would like to think it is just, you know, making sure dickwad is a part of our lexicon.
I know. I love it. And then Robin also said, I never heard anyone say dickwad before Hellbent. And now dickwad's be gone is my mantra. Like, yes.
That is what sustains us.
Yes,
dickwad's be gone. That is what keeps us fighting.
I love that. Yeah, I love that.
We always love that. And we love ladies who swear.
Oh, yeah.
Just anyone who swears, really. But really. Especially ladies. Stephanie, she said to us, quote, "You two are phenomenal ladies. The growth and fluidity you've developed since the start is amazing. Stay hellbent." Which is really sweet. I feel like we've grown a lot.
Yeah.
And it's wild to think that we've only been doing this for 4 months.
I know. I love that feedback because, you know, if you go back and listen to our first episodes, please don't judge us. No, but we really have, like, the rapport and our, like, skills, recording, audio. It all just is better. It works better.
I used to work in soccer, and the term we refer to when, like, a team has hit its stride is mid-season form.
Right.
Because it's like they've gotten,
used to each other.
Yeah, and they're playing with each other.
Right.
They've gotten reps in. They're, like, match fit.
Right.
Sorry, I gotta give some, like, sports
jargon.
It's funny, though, because the jargon. That made me laugh. But the first episode, we really treated like a pilot.
Yeah.
We're like, we didn't even know if we were going to do anything beyond that.
No.
We're like, if it's shitty, we can call a day. Like, we don't need to
do
this.
It's fine.
And we liked it enough that we were like, let's just do that. I mean, we like talking to each other.
I know.
So let's just do it.
Well, I remember I listened to the first episode recently, and I was like, oh, man, I'm really glad that that convinced us, because it would not have convinced me now.
Yeah, we have a higher bar now. As Devin said, we have standards.
That was news to me. Apparently we do.
Yeah, now she knows. Cassie also said, also really sweet feedback, "This show is a bright light in dark times. Listen and bask. Thanks, Devin and Sarah." And thank you. I mean, it's a bright spot for us. We've said this before, but we feel like doing this podcast is a form of self-care.
Yes.
It's a way for us to process everything and talk about it and, you know, just feel like we're not alone.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. And so your feedback really means a lot. So thank you for that. We also had a great bit of feedback from an anonymous listener who reached out regarding our discussion on Jughead's asexuality, aromanticism erasure from the show Riverdale. She said, quote, "Wanted to thank you so much for discussing, describing, and validating asexuality on your latest episode. I didn't realize that asexuality was a legitimate sexual identity until a couple of years ago, and it took me a year to come out to my family and a couple of very close friends. Even now, I'm mostly closeted. Asexual representation and validation is absolutely critical. I thought there was something wrong with me for years, and then once I realized there are others like me, it was as though an enormous burden was lifted off my shoulders. I'm still trying to figure out how to navigate my asexuality, and I wish there were more understanding and acceptance in both the general populace and the LGBTQIA community." And I think that's just says it all to me.
It does.
You know, and it goes back to what we were talking about from the feedback from a different listener.
Right.
That representation is so important. And just, like, validating it and talking about it helps make people feel less alone.
Absolutely. I mean, we get that feedback about this podcast a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just again, like, not feeling alone.
Yeah.
And that's why representation matters in pop culture, in politics,
everywhere.
You know, everywhere. It's so important to see yourself somewhere.
Yeah. And so thank you to everyone who's giving us this kind of feedback.
Yeah.
We always appreciate when people share their stories with us.
Absolutely. Okay, so we have some merch updates. So
merch updates.
So some of you friends may have noticed that our shop is down. It's closed.
Temporarily.
We move our inventory over to a new provider. So I was trying to do it piecemeal and that was bullshit. So I was just like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm shutting it down.
This is the provider that we had initially.
Yes.
This is the second provider.
This is the
one offers more sizes. So we're trying, basically what Devin's saying is we're moving everything over to this provider, which we've already switched some of the items to. So it'll be temporarily down.
Yes. So it looks like, you know, the shop will be up no later than Monday, June 26th. So check back soon. And when we return, we will have shirts in extended sizes, totes, mugs, travel mugs.
Yeah, yes.
Stickers, accessory pouches, and my personal favorite, postcards.
Yeah, Devin designed postcards that you can send your representatives, which I'm kind of mad that we didn't think of in the first place. But I love when you brought that idea to me. I was like, yes.
So, you know, if you'd like to call your representative Dickwad, I have a postcard for you. So get excited.
Also, do you have like a little update for the local politics is sexy? Didn't we hear back from that provider about what happened?
Yeah. So there would have been a problem where someone had gotten a shirt where the front was blank.
Yeah. My friend Marta.
Yeah. Where the local politics is sexy was supposed to be was blank.
And it disappeared. And it like disappeared.
A dick one. Like a dick one. Bye. And so I reached out to our provider. As some of you may know, like, it may be invisible, but I have a "can I speak to your manager" haircut. So, you know, people, they love talking to me. But they, you know, they were very nice. They were like, "That is totally on our end.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Like, we will, you know, definitely monitor quality control for you, for our account specifically." And, you know.
And
they're resending.
Resend that.
Yeah.
So if you bought a local politics is sexy t-shirt and you had a similar issue, please reach out to us so we can get you sorted.
Get you sorted out.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, time goes by so fast, but we're getting toward the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the beginning of every month, we send out a newsletter.
Right.
We have a monthly newsletter. So we want to just remind you that if you want to sign up for the newsletter, and we highly recommend it because we're a little biased toward ourselves, you can do so at hellbentpodcast.com/newsletter. It's fun. It's funny. We do our like favorite articles of the month. We have merch deals. We make silly jokes that are, you know, that you would might recognize on the podcast.
It's called Raisin Hell.
We like it.
We think we're great.
So do that. And then finally, if you want to be part of our Facebook group, just another reminder, we have a Facebook group with all of our hellion friends.
Hellion friends.
It's called Dickwads Be Gone, a Hellbent podcast fan group.
Yes. Okay, Sarah. So we have some Trump GOP man bun Ken bullshit to discuss. I think it's only fitting that we start with the Ossoff and Parnell runs.
Yes.
And what happened there?
Yeah. So on Tuesday, there were two special elections. And more eyes, I would say, were on Ossoff's race in the Georgia 6th than Parnell's in the South Carolina 5th. So Ossoff, you know, he lost a very closely contested and the most expensive race in House history.
Yeah.
He lost that election by just 3.8 points. And this was a district that Tom Price won by plus 23. So the turnaround in the span of just 7 months is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And then the special election in South Carolina, in the South Carolina 5th, Democrat Archie Parnell only lost by 3.2. So that was much closer than expected.
Yeah.
And also in that district, Mick Mulvaney, who's now Trump's budget chief, he had won his election in November by over 20 points. So these are like, they closed the gap in the span of months, which is amazing.
And, you know, we're going to get into some bad takes and some man bun Ken things that we need to talk about. But I would like to say first, like, look, right, we didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't win any of the four special elections.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? We got really fucking close.
Yeah.
And in this situation in particular, margins matter.
Yeah.
And so swinging these, you know, gaps, you know,
There's a lot more seats that are way more vulnerable that with that swing would be overtaken by Democrats.
Absolutely.
So that's something to keep in mind for 2018. We're not going to be Pollyanna about it. And like, I mean, obviously it's a bummer that Karen fucking Handel and some other Republican dickwad in South Carolina is being sent to Congress. But again, they're up for re-election in 2018.
Yeah, these are going to be short terms. And honestly, like, people who are like, "We didn't win, boo," like, Democrats put a win on the board. Like, this is a fucking win.
Yeah.
We swung 20 percentage points.
This is a good sign for the resistance.
It's a good sign.
So we'll get into that. So let's go over some of the bad takes first before we get into our, you know, uplifting
takes. I know,
That felt important.
It felt important to say.
So I expected the takes to be bad if Ossoff lost, but I didn't realize they would be this bad. Like, they were bad.
Bad. Okay, so my personal favorite bad take.
And by favorite, you mean
least awful. Favorite, awful, horrible asshole. So Matthew Stoller said that Ossoff was packaged terribly, looks like he's 13, and that Dems should have won this easily. Okay.
I mean, like, again, we're not going to be Pollyanna and, like, overly rosy about this.
No, but it wasn't going to be easy.
This was never going to be easy. And if you think it was easy, I don't think you understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And also, like, I mean, I don't think it's fair to get into anyone's looks or anything. No. I just think he's the wrong person to say that John Ossoff looks like he's 13.
Also, like, too, should we talk about Tom Cotton? Which, again, I don't want to talk about looks too much, but he literally looks like he's, like, runs the high school yearbook.
Just don't cast stones.
It doesn't, yeah. On glass right? houses. Like, come on.
Come on, guys. Literally, friends. Guys. No.
No, literally, guys. You're right.
They're man bun Kens.
Man bun Kens. Go ahead. Come on, guys.
And then the usual sort of suspects were like, see, this is why we need to run on socialism everywhere. Yeah. And it was like, okay, first of all, and specifically they were talking about the Georgia Six.
Yeah.
First of all, Bernie lost the Democratic primary in Georgia by 43 points.
43.
Like
4-3, 43.
Even Georgia Democratic voters were like, nah.
Nah.
Like, this doesn't work for us here, okay? second of all, people who actually live in the district were like, LOL, no, you don't understand local politics.
Right.
It's a lot of people from outside the district, like, prescribing.
Right.
Which is really obnoxious.
It is obnoxious. And I think that there was even some discussion about, you know, the sort of all the national attention it was getting.
Yeah.
And people sort of jumping into this very local
right.
politics sort of environment. And that can be very obnoxious because unless you live there, it is really hard to understand.
If I were in a district and I had outside people telling me how to run things, I would be annoyed.
Exactly.
And so this guy, at Jason Kirk SBN, he tweeted, y'all don't understand how silly, quote, the Democrats would have won that district by being more liberal sounds, but thank you for visiting.
Yeah, it's like, I'm sorry, have you been to Georgia?
Yeah.
Like, have...
Do you even know what you're talking about?
Right.
That's, I think, for me... The biggest problem is that it's ridiculous for anyone, be it a man bun Ken or us,
right,
to think that their own sort of rigid ideas of what an ideal candidate looks like would work in every single district.
It's not going to.
There's no one, you know, cookie cutter, this is how you run everywhere. There's just too many variable factors to contend with. And like, you know, Jason Kirk said, like, you think a more liberal person would be able to win? No. You don't know what you're talking about. Yeah,
Georgia's in the South.
Yeah.
I don't care how liberal it looks. Unless you're there, you don't know.
Yeah, you just don't know.
You just don't know what the actual environment feels like.
Yeah. And then this one, I have to say, took me by surprise, this take.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why it did. In retrospect, it shouldn't have. But, like, out of the woodwork, it's like... You know, they all, a bunch of man bun Kens got together and were like, we're going to talk about how terrible Nancy Pelosi is.
Right.
And go.
Which really, it felt like that did come out of nowhere.
It really like, did. It was like, it was this weird, like, group thing. It was like, one guy was like, this is, like, they were
this
basically.
This is Pelosi's fault.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, yep, let's run.
Every
let's
white
run
guy got, like, the bat signal. It was like, yeah, let's tweet about how it's all Pelosi's fault. And I was just like, what? How is a white man overperforming in a deeply red district? Her fucking fault.
Yeah, right?
Like, there was a one headline where it was like, wake up, Democrats. This isn't Ossoff's fault. It's Nancy Pelosi's fault. I'm like, what? It's what? No. You don't get to do this. Like, I'm sorry. Like, no. So I want to read a couple of tweets that I feel like really encapsulates how I feel about this. So at Candy Apple Ally tweeted, quote, the Pelosi must go campaign reminds me that if Republicans demonize a successful woman enough, Democratic dudes will eventually join
in. That's a really good way to put it.
Which is so fucking true. I mean, you saw it with the way Hillary Clinton was demonized. You know, all those dudes were like, well, I'd vote for a woman, just not that woman, because she got demonized so thoroughly.
Yeah.
That they bought into it. It was just too easy for them to buy into that. I also think that Alexandra Aaron had a really great thread about this that just sort of encapsulated all my feelings. She said, quote, I don't know why people keep thinking that if the Dems would replace their woman at the top, the GOP would go easier on their replacements. Quote, Pelosi was a major drag because the GOP has been demonizing her in part because she is an effective legislative foil for them, but also because she's there at the top. Replace Nancy Pelosi with Brandon Pabrosi.
Pabrosi, that's good.
I like that. Now, Brandon's the drag. It's like the people who think if Bernie had been on the ticket in November, Trump would still have been running against Clinton. I don't think Sun Tzu wrote The Art of the War, quote, never let your opponent pick your general for you, because who would be foolish enough to? Like, I think that's a good point. Like,
it is
why
a good
are
point.
We,
why are we talking about this?
Why are we feeding into the bait that Republicans are putting out there, hook, line, and sinker, and being like, yeah, we should definitely get rid of our most, effective legislator who gets her fucking party in line and opposes, has been really effective in the minority.
She's been super effective.
Like, the reason why they demonize her partly is because
she's good at her job.
They're afraid of her.
They're afraid of her.
Yeah. And then Alexandra said,
But that's where we are constantly with our willingness to knuckle under to the GOP's ongoing rolling smear campaign against Democratic leaders. And maybe the GOP has an easier time demonizing women like Pelosi and Clinton or men of color like Ellison and President Obama, but that's no reason to capitulate to them. It's a strong reason not to.
It's a beautiful way to put it.
Hard agree. So hard agree. honestly, like, white men are not the base of the Democratic Party, so their opinion about it don't hold a lot of weight to me.
Like, I really don't care.
That would be my advice to everyone is don't listen to white men as much.
Well, right. Well, and again,
don't take their word as gospel.
Well, like you said, like the Nancy Pelosi takes kind of felt like they came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I was reading them and I remember I was thinking, like, wait, why are we talking about Nancy Pelosi?
Well, because they...
I know. They did the smear campaign.
They tried to... Yeah. That was a rhetorical question. But just for those, Hellions who don't know, they tried to tie Ossoff to Pelosi. But they also tried to tie him to Bernie Sanders. No one's telling Bernie Sanders to go the fuck away.
It's true.
We know this.
That's true.
So let's go into some better takes.
Yeah. Here. And I will say, I mean, I am a little more, like, as I've said a lot this episode, I'm more Pollyanna pants about this. Like, I
am too.
I'm not really sad about this.
Well, I think the problem with Democrats is there's too much like Eeyoring
I've talked about.
Like, I'm like, I get that we didn't win and that's disappointing, but there's, if one of our listeners, she responded to one of my tweets, her name is Sarah as well. She said, Republicans have no shame and Democrats have too much.
Yeah.
Like, we just go into full Eeyore mode.
Right.
I'm like, stop it.
Yeah, exactly.
No. Like, this. Like, have some pride. Like, God damn it.
The Democratic Party overperformed in two very red districts.
Yeah.
I don't understand how that's a bad thing.
And all the other red districts that were run before
also,
these special elections.
Right.
So, shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up. I'm actually super happy about this.
Yeah.
And so, Jason Johnson from The Root argued that Purnell in South Carolina 5th did so much better than expected because he had effective get out the vote strategies for black voters.
Who are the base of the party, lest we forget, white men.
He said, quote, politics can be a simple game when you actually target your own voters instead of someone else's. And I love that.
Yeah, I do too. And I also think too, Parnell may have benefited from not as much of a spotlight.
Yes.
I mean, the Republicans had to spend so much money to keep their seat red.
Right.
That's not Ossoff's fault at all. I don't think that's Ossoff's fault. I think it's just an indication that the Republicans had to really dig deep into their war chest to keep a seat that was supposed to be reliably red.
Right. It was Newt Gingrich's seat. It was Newt Gingrich's seat.
I mean,
that
is
tell you something.
Win in and of itself.
Yeah.
I also love what Flippable said. Mm-hmm. So he said, quote, binary politics where only wins and losses matter work for presidential elections and even midterms, not specials. Margins matter a lot, which is what you were saying.
Right.
And then Dave Wasserman, he tweeted, quote, in four special elections, Dems have, or he basically said this, in four special elections, Dems have overperformed the partisan baseline in their districts by an average of 8 percentage points.
That's so many percentage points. I mean, I cannot stress, like, when you look at voting and statistics, 8 percentage points
in, like, 7 months
is a ridiculous number.
That's the average.
Right.
And then Swing Left tweeted, quote, it won't be easy, but winning back the House is still very much in reach. 47 GOP-held districts are more Dem-leaning than Georgia 6. And remember, we need to gain a net 24.
Right.
So that,
it's looking good.
I mean, again, a lot can change between now and 2018, but right now we're trending well.
Yeah, please, don't Eeyore around. And then lastly, we really, really want to talk about something that Sarah Kendzior said about voter suppression. She said, quote, using Ossoff versus Handel as a prognosticator of the 2018 midterms ignores the very likely possibility that the midterms will not be free or fair. The priority of the Democrats or anyone who values freedom and fairness should be combating voter suppression. It does not matter how great your candidate is if people cannot vote, and it does not matter what their platform is if millions are disenfranchised. It is very likely that they will be.
Yeah, and so we had her on our podcast last week, which one of my favorite interviews, and she had mentioned that she doesn't think that the Republicans, she thinks they don't fear the consequences of this healthcare bill,
right?
Because she thinks they're planning future voter suppression.
Yeah.
So she's like, there's a reason why they were proceeding, even though this is super unpopular.
Right.
And it's because they
basically, she said they probably are counting on the fact that they're going to suppress enough votes to win.
To win, right.
So voter suppression, I think, in general, is something Democrats should absolutely focus on. That should be one of our biggest priorities.
Absolutely.
If not our biggest priority.
Voter suppression, gerrymandering, mm-hmm. you know, and making sure that, like she said, these are free and fair elections.
Yeah.
And, you know,
we can't be a full democracy if everyone doesn't have the right to vote.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's move on. Speaking of the healthcare bill.
Right.
Let's move on to what we've learned about it.
So because is the healthcare bill great, Sarah?
It is the opposite.
Ugh.
So the Republicans have been keeping it in secret for a really long time. They finally have unveiled a draft of the bill, and predictably, it really fucking sucks.
It sucks.
So let's go through some of these things. So it would roll back the ACA's taxes, phase down its Medicaid expansion, rejigger its subsidies, give states wider latitude in opting out of its regulations, and eliminate federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And it would also eliminate Medicaid reimbursements for Planned Parenthood for a year. So let's go into the... So that's sort of the overview.
Overview.
So let's go into the nitty-gritty. So the Senate bill gives much greater flexibility to the ACA's existing state waivers, and it would revoke the essential health benefits requirement, at least according to Bob Casey, who's a senator from Pennsylvania. And he tweeted this morning, "This means insurance companies are no longer required to cover things like maternity care and emergency services. This will affect everyone."
Yeah. I get so mad about the maternity care
thing.
I get so mad. They're like...
Where did these Republican senators think they came from?
I was going to say, like, do they have wives or mistresses or, like, daughters or literally anyone in their whole fucking life that maybe will be pregnant at some point?
They seem to invoke the daughters and wives thing when it's... convenient. But
well, Man Bun Ken is a feminist because he has a mother.
Yeah.
Like, fuck you. So it also abolishes two of ACA's central mandates that individuals must show proof of insurance when filing their taxes, which basically requires you to keep up viable health insurance. And that firms with 50 workers or more must provide health coverage. So it's providing less money for moderate and low-income Americans buying insurance on the individual market. So basically they're saying, you know, you no longer have to have health insurance, which everyone's super excited about for some reason. And that if you are a firm with 50 or more workers, you no longer have to provide health mm-hmm. insurance.
Yeah, and this bill largely mirrors the House one, like
yeah.
we sort of talked about on Monday. And they had said, oh, you know, it's going to be so different. No. But there are some significant changes that are aimed at trying to please moderates. Like, there's this balance of trying to, you know, throw some bones at the moderates, throw mm-hmm. some bones at the hardline conservatives. So let's go through some of the similarities and differences. So mm-hmm. while the House legislation pegged federal insurance subsidies to age, the Senate bill would link them to income as the ACA does.
Yeah, pegging them to age is a really... weird choice anyway. We can go into that completely separately, but
yeah.
I just wanted to say that's a really odd thing for them to have done.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like the Senate was like, no, we'll link it
right.
to income. And the measure would preserve, so this measure would preserve two of the ACA's most popular provisions. So insurers could not deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions, and children may stay on their parents' plans until the age of 26. So I guess that's
something.
Something. But still, this whole bill is... The rest of this bill is trash. Because the other thing about the subsidies, so the insurance subsidies are currently available to Americans earning between 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level. But starting in 2020, that threshold would be lowered to 350% under the Senate bill. But anyone below that line could get the subsidies if they're not eligible for Medicaid. But again, it seems like they're trying to phase out Medicaid.
Right.
So,
well, so it does cut off Medicaid expansion more gradually than the House bill, but it would enact deeper long-term cuts to the program for low-income Americans. So, okay, so it's not as fast, but in the long term, it's actually more money that
yeah.
they're taking away. And it removes language restricting federally subsidized health plans from covering abortions, which may have run afoul of complex budget rules.
Yeah, so the House, I think, tried to put that in there,
yeah.
and the Senate
was
removed
like,
that language because I think they're like, we can't get past this.
We have so many issues.
So the aides that went on background about this bill yesterday, they stressed that the GOP plan is likely to undergo more changes in order to garner the 50 votes. So moderate senators are concerned about cutting off coverage too fast for those who gained it under ACA, while conservatives don't want to leave big parts of the ACA in place.
I just love this dichotomy.
Yeah.
And by love, I mean hate. Go
yeah.
fuck yourself. But moderate senators are concerned about cutting off coverage too fast, not about cutting it off.
Yeah.
Just doing it too fast.
Right.
And then, like, hardliners are like, well, it leaves too much of the ACA in place.
Yeah, we don't like the things that work in the ACA.
Yeah, like, what?
So speaking of this balance that they're, right. You know, Mitch McConnell and his, you know, gang of dickwads are, you know, what they're doing. So Chuck Todd tweeted, per a solid source, at least three GOP senators, perhaps more, plan to announce public opposition to the McConnell health care bill later. And then, lo and behold, Rand Paul tweeted, today I joined Senators Lee, Johnson, and Cruz in opposition to the health care bill. And then Dean Heller, who's a senator from Nevada, and he's also up for re-election in 2018, said he, quote, has serious concerns.
I mean, look, Republicans love to talk about their serious concerns with these shitty bills. But you know what? They fall in line. Republicans fucking fall in line.
That's the thing. I don't trust it. I think a lot of these senators are putting a show on, either to get things in the bill that they want,
right,
or to show to their constituents,
right,
like
positive press
that, oh, we oppose it. But again, like Devin said, Republicans always fucking fall in line, and I just don't trust that any of them are going to vote no.
No, absolutely not.
I think we need to keep going hard at them. On a related note, the CBO says it's aiming to release a score of this bill early next week. Again, like, the last CBO score of the House bill said 23 million would ultimately be uninsured,
right,
by, I don't remember what year. Was it 2020?
I think it was 2020.
Yeah. But correct us if we're wrong.
Yeah. Evans. And also that timeline is so short, especially if Mitch McConnell is in fact trying to get this through before the July 4th recess. Next week is really late to have a CBO score.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, again, there have been no fucking hearings on it.
Nope.
And the public really fucking hates it. Yeah. A new poll that was out this morning shows that only 16% favor this bill and 48% oppose, versus for Obamacare, 41% favor, 38% oppose, and 28% want to fix it. So that's a big reason why Republicans aren't holding hearings. They're trying to jam this through because they know we hate it.
We hate it, and it sucks.
And as Chris Hayes tweeted, the basic ingredients for House and Senate were always going to be the same. Huge tax cuts for the rich, paid for by the benefits cut for the poor.
Yeah.
To the poor. And that just says it all.
It does.
It's reverse Robin Hood.
It is reverse Robin Hood. That's a really good way to put it. Yeah. It's so frustrating. So let's go into like a really, really quick Russia update.
Yeah.
So first off, I'm going to present this without comment. Sessions has hired his own lawyer.
They all have lawyers now.
lawyers, lawyers party.
I mean, our last episode title was called The Nesting Doll of Attorneys.
Yeah,
that's basically what's happening.
Oh, yeah. So also, just basically what's going on with Russia. There is so much evidence of collusion, and now everyone from Mueller to the fucking president has admitted that Trump is under investigation for obstruction of justice.
So technically, we don't have hardline evidence, but you're saying there's so much that indicates
collusion. Well, yeah, but there is hardline evidence. There is, like, video of, like, evidence of, you know, these sort of pieces that point to...
What do you mean, video?
Collusion. So they're of like... Trump saying things and doing things.
Trump saying, for example, that he fired Comey because of Russia.
Yes, exactly.
Hopefully the P tape.
Seriously, just like make my year.
Yeah.
Like make 2016 okay.
Yeah, and like we've talked about before, Mueller has really expanded his probe. He's hiring a lot of top-notch people. Like,
right.
He's a force to be reckoned with.
He is. And so this Russian interference also, the interference, the collusion, the obstruction of justice, this all runs parallel to other... election operations that Russia has held, i.e. Le Pen in France. And so, you know, without tax returns, it's impossible to see Donald Trump's, like, sort of financial burden. Like,
and we might not see it so obviously. Like, there would be maybe a trail that we could follow.
But without it, there's not even a trail.
Right.
But we do know that this is how Russia generally carries out.
And again, this is not going to be the last time that they try something.
No.
They've seen that it works. They have 3 years advance time to do it for presidential elections. And if they're seeing that our government is not holding
you know, going hard after this. They're just going to keep doing it even more.
Even more. And then because we really needed more fuel for the Man Bun Ken meme this week, Karl Rove had this to say, which is like, why is Karl Rove still talking? Who knows? But he had this to say, quote, there is no evidence that Mr. Trump acted with criminal purpose. For example, that he was bribed to shut down the Flynn investigation, or that he was trying to hide some personal financial interest in Mr. Flynn's foreign lobbying.
I would say Man Bun Ken to me is more like left bros, but I feel like we could apply it to just any mansplaining.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, this was just like the most like mansplainy, like, well, he might have obstructed justice, but there was no criminal intent to obstructing the justice.
There's just so many excuses for, like, Trump.
Please stop.
In other news, Spice Wad. We haven't talked about Spice Wad in a while.
No, he hasn't been at the podium lately. It's been Sarah Sanders, Huckabee Sanders, so...
And also, they've restricted some of these press briefings in significant ways.
Which is really scary. I still would like to sound the alarm on that.
Yeah, but he's, you know, still being bad at being press secretary. Mm-hmm. Peter Alexander, who's a national correspondent for NBC News, tweeted, stunningly, Sean Spicer says he has never asked President Trump whether he believes Russia interfered in the election. What the fuck? Not true. I mean, no, that is not true.
I know.
And then also, Mike Flynn, the New York City cockroach.
Who just will not go away.
Will not go away. There was a story about briefings he received.
Yes.
While, you know, Sally Yates was like, sounded the alarm. Exactly. This guy could be compromised.
So, there at 18, Flynn was fired 18 days after Sally Yates went to the White House counsel mm-hmm. to say that there's a problem. And every day in those 18 days, Flynn was there for the presidential daily brief. And other classified sort of briefings.
Yeah.
So, and so now they're kind of asking, so the CIA director, Mike Pompeo, who was present for these briefings, he was sworn in 3 days before Sally Yates brought her concerns to the White House. So they're wondering, did he know? Did mm-hmm. he know about Sally Yates' concerns and he still gave these briefings to Flynn?
Yeah. We have no idea.
We don't know. And he's not saying
either he was ignorant or he was irresponsible, to say the least.
Or both.
Oh, both. It's always both.
It's always both.
Okay, so we're excited to announce our guest for today. Brittany Packnett is an education executive, activist, a co-founder of Stay Woke, and was a member of President Obama's 21st Century Policing Task Force. Packnett regularly contributes to Crooked Media's Pod Save the People and is a board member of Rise to Run, a group that recruits and trains young progressive women to run for office. And really, that's just the tip of the iceberg. We're thrilled to have her on the show. Welcome to Hellbent, Brittany.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, like we said, you contribute to a different podcast, Pod Save the People. So when you're on other podcasts, does it feel like podcast inception a little bit?
Podception.
A little bit. You know, I also did, I did Love It or Leave It live a couple of weeks ago. Mm. And it was my first time doing a podcast live. And so I wasn't quite expecting the audience reaction.
Right.
So that's fun. But podcasts are great. I saw this picture where somebody was like sitting next to an advertisement of people talking and laughing. And they're like, that's what a podcast feels like, right? Like you're just talking to your friends.
Yeah.
So it's awesome. The more the merrier.
Yeah. I have to say that episode of Love It or Leave It was my favorite one to date. Like, and I loved you on the panel.
Yeah.
And I just was glad to see that there were three women on the panel. I was like, you should do that more. Love It. I like that.
Come on,
like,
Love It.
Like three diverse women. Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Yeah. It was a good time. It was definitely a good time.
Yeah. Well, we're excited to talk to you today about Rise to Run. And like, if you look at the board of Rise to Run, it really reads like a political all-star list, from you to Gavin Newsom to Simone Sanders to Kara Swisher. Like, the list goes on. And what was your first reaction when you were asked to join the team?
You know, I was totally honored. I actually met Helen because I decided to personally endorse Hillary Clinton, which was, like I said, a very personal decision. It was one that some people were confused by, other people totally got. We were fairly late in the game, and I was worried that millennials and millennials of color in particular, that we weren't having truthful conversations about the stakes. Mm. I feel like, fortunately, we're seeing a lot of that come right now with everything from what's happening at the Department of Education to how many departments are cutting their civil rights investigations, right? So the EPA, DOJ, Ed, Labor, and then, you know, obviously the things that Jeff Sessions is doing around reversing all of the strides that have been made in criminal justice reform. I was just really worried that we weren't considering that stuff fully. I remember being on the campaign trail for her and talking to some brilliant young organizers, but who had been told by folks that they really only needed to worry about local tickets, and that the federal government wouldn't affect us that much, right? And so we had a long conversation about Senate appointments and the Supreme Court and all of these kinds of things. So I'm proud of the work that we did there, even though obviously we didn't get the desired result. But I had been in a lot of communication with Helen Bronson at that time. She founded Rise to Run. At the time, she worked for the campaign. And we finally met on the fateful night of Election Day. We finally met in person at the Javits Center, you know, and it was like hugs all around, congratulations. All the polls were telling us we should feel really good. And so I was just really inspired by someone with whom I've gotten to know and become friends, who didn't let a night as depressing and heart-wrenching as that become a reason to close up shop, right? But become a reason to do more. And so whenever there is an opportunity to step up and support that kind of action, I like to do what I can. And I was really inspired by Helen's vision, not only to recruit more women, but to be intentional about recruiting progressive women, young women, women of color, to diversify the spaces that we're in, to no longer see healthcare bills like the one we're dealing with right now, because we're not at the policy making and policy writing table. Right. So I truly believe in what Rise to Run is doing. And I'm excited for all of the young women we're going to recruit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's such an amazing organization.
Yeah.
And so you kind of touched on it, but Black women, they actually vote more than any other group, but they remain underrepresented in public office. So in what ways is Rise to Run addressing this specific issue? And kind of similarly, how can the Democratic Party help move the needle there?
I think, and you already listed some of the board members, but I think you can, specifically around Black women, you can look at people like myself and Simone and know that this organization is not going to shy away from women of color, Black women who will be brutally honest. Simone and I are also good friends. We get a lot of hate online and in real life about things that we say that are like totally true, right? About and internalized oppression and what it means to be a Black woman at work. And whenever you confront systems of oppression, you can expect to receive retribution in return, right? And so it is telling that an organization like Rise to Run doesn't run away from people like us, but that it embraces people like us. So I think one of the things that it is doing is it's sending the message that you don't have to be the, quote, perfect political candidate, right? Who's never made a controversial statement, right? Who's never lived real life, right? And lived in the real world and experienced all the things that women have to deal with every single day. That actually we want people who represent women of all stripes. We want people who have that real life experience and to bring that to bear in the policy making space. So, you know, we're trying to set forward a new pathway that says you don't have to be some kind of experienced, perfect candidate. In fact, we want you to be somebody who's real, who knows how to listen, who knows how to take action, and who knows how to move forward for everyday people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. It kind of on that vein, what do you say to women who don't feel like they're qualified or maybe are nervous about how vicious political campaigns can be? And, you know, you kind of touched on that, like women are almost not allowed to be three-dimensional. And like, you know, there's an expectation of perfection. So absolutely. So what's your advice to women who are a little bit nervous?
Well, I mean, when we have that conversation, we have to be honest about it. I think when we deny that fear, when we don't validate those legitimate worries, we lead people down the wrong pathway, right? We lead people down a pathway where they're ill-prepared to take on these things. And so I say two things. One is that I say, you know, there are lots of folks in Congress and in positions of power right now who were not at all qualified for this. So, like, girl, don't worry about your qualifications. right? Somebody sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue who was not ready for that job, right? We see that every single day. So, but truly, right, that like if this is your passion and you are really intentional about helping people, especially through institutions of policymaking, then you should always consider running for office, working for people who are in office or running for office, because all of that deeply matters. And if we're not at the table, we're on the table, as I always say. But the second thing I say, though, is that it's up to us to be honest with one another about what those struggles and worries are so that we can build a force field around you, right? I mean, that is the other reason why organizations like Rise to Run are so important, because you've got experienced politicos, experienced communicators, experienced policymakers, not only on our board of advisors or board of directors, rather, but also who are stepping up in mentorship roles, right? To make sure that as young people, as young women take this on, that they can actually handle all of the arrows that will be thrown their way. And so, you know, it's a lie when we tell people, oh, you'll be fine, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's up to young women as they enter this work to say, here are all of the things I'm worried about that can come at me, so that we can both prepare you and prepare ourselves to be your army, to be
I love that.
I do. So kind of which women candidates are you keeping close tabs on and are particularly excited about right now?
Oh, so, gosh, so many people. I really, obviously Kamala Harris, right? Like, she's just a G.
She's our senator.
Yeah, not to brag or anything.
I'm supremely jealous of that, because she's a senator and because you have, like, year-round sunshine.
Right.
you know, and there are people like that who are following in the footsteps of folks like Maxine Waters and others who have been at this for a long time. I'm really excited by Nikita Oliver, who's running for mayor in Seattle. She is often kind of called the Black Lives Matter candidate, and she is that and so much more. She's making a really viable run, and I think there's an opportunity for folks to see that at the foundation of the movement is really a conversation about equity and liberation, and equity and liberation must be applicable in every field, right? It's not just about police violence. It's about education. It's about housing. It's about transportation. It's about the environment. It's about labor. It's about all of the things that people in elected office have to take care of, right? And so to have someone with that kind of mindset and that, the kind of tenacity that Nikita Oliver does in the mayor's office, I think would be a really phenomenal thing. So I'm definitely keeping an eye on her. And, you know, would encourage listeners to check out her platform and support her if they feel so led.
Yeah, we definitely will. We're also really excited about Stacey Abrams, who's running for governor in Georgia. And we're, we talk about her a lot.
Yeah, we're big fans.
She also, just fun fact about her, she apparently writes romance novels on the side and has, like, a pen name and stuff. Like, I love it.
We have many dimensions, don't
I know, we? Exactly. Exactly.
I think that's why we were so intrigued. You're like, you're a
lawyer, and you write your pen name, right? Selena Montgomery, like you're a badass. Exactly.
I just, you know, I like for my women leaders to be multi-talented, and I believe Stacey Abrams, for lots of reasons, including the romance novels, absolutely fits the bill. She's very exciting to watch. You know, there's a question about how we campaign, and I think that people like Nikita and Stacey are campaigning in a way that is really honest, in a way that is very forthright, in a way that has a lot of integrity. And that gives us an indication of how they will govern, right? And so I'm really hoping that folks in Seattle and Georgia trust women like that and so many more as we move forward in this work.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Speaking of, you worked within government. You interned for Representative Lacey Clay during college, and you also worked as a legislative aide from 2009 to 2010. So for you, how did that experience shape your perspective about the political process and actually impacting change from the inside?
You know, so I, if I had to do it all over again, my second major probably would have been political science. I majored in African American studies and minored in English lit. But I find myself really intrigued by institutions, right? And what it means to shift institutions, both from the outside and inside. I never feel like it can be a one-directional game, right? Protesters need policymakers. Policymakers need protesters, right? policymakers need protesters to give the kind of street credibility and push to actually make people take action. And protesters need policymakers to take what we're demanding on the street and actually codify it, right? And solidify it and make sure that it's the law of the land. So I believe in, I won't even say bi-directional, but multi-directional strategy. That said, given my interest in policy, given my experience in the classroom teaching here in DC, I have always felt like taking that kind of experience and perspective to the policymaking space was something that I could have a strong impact in, right? So when I interned, I totally got bitten with the bug. When I worked for Congressman Clay, I worked on issues of domestic social policy. So I was there when Obamacare was passed, right?
And oh,
I
remember, wow.
Right,
2009.
Yeah, 2009 to 2010 is when I was on the Hill, which you have to remember. So I worked for a progressive Democratic congressman. Barack Obama was in the White House. Congress was still blue. And so this was just a very different time than what we to over the last 6-7 years. And so there was a lot that people were trying to push while they still had the opportunity, and Obamacare was one of them. So I remember going to the Democratic Whips meeting, right, where usually it's legislative directors, but my LD let me go with her. And remembering seeing Jim Clyburn, who was the first Black whip of the United States House of Representatives, to thank the staffers for getting this thing through and doing all the hard work and answering all the phone calls and doing all the negotiations and, you know, rallying the troops to make this happen. And so I was excited by what government can do. I was also worried about what happens when we put all of our eggs in one basket. So I've worked on policy both from the inside and the outside, and know that we need talented people who put equity and liberation first in all of those positions.
Sure. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, you can't ever just do it one way.
Yeah.
So do you think you'll ever run for office?
This is not the first time I've been asked.
I imagine not.
Because I'm saying I would vote for you.
Yeah.
I would 100% vote for you.
That's very sweet. And, you know, to your question earlier, I also have worries, right? I'm like, what tweets are going to come back to haunt me, right? Like, what Instagram pictures? Oh, right?
That's Sarah says that all the time. She's like, if I ever ran for office, my Twitter is just opposition research gold.
Yeah.
We're all of it, right? All of it. So, you know, I have real worries about what it would mean to run for office. I will never say never. I feel like right now I am best positioned and most useful working on things from other angles as a protester, as someone who works in an education institution that trains teachers. Like, I just feel like there are lots of ways that we can look at this. And I think especially sometimes with people of color, we actually over index on just running for office and forget about all of the folks it takes to both get somebody elected and then help somebody govern, right? Mm. So I'm also just interested in like, how we make sure that all of these women through organizations like Rise to Run and others, that we get interested in politics, period, that we're not only preparing candidates, but we're preparing legislative directors and policy analysts and chiefs of staff, right? Yeah. And like, and interns and intern coordinators. I mean, it takes a lot of folks to make this thing run and to make a candidate work well. And so I don't know that that is my position, but maybe one day. Helen asked me time we talk.
No? Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of women, just like, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand said, like, we don't think of ourselves as, you know, politicians in the automatic way that maybe men do. Like, men turn 30 and they're like, I could be a senator. And women are like, I need, well, like, 17.
I just be an all-star baseball player. Like, why not?
Why not? And, like, we're like, we need 17 years of experience.
Yeah.
And but I also think, too, that being a politician isn't necessarily for everyone. Like, there are different, like you said, to affect change, it's a multidirectional thing, and there are other ways to be impactful. And something like Rise to Run is a great organization because you can just, you know, amplify other women and lift other women up, and I love that.
And that is, you know, I think about, we've talked about Simone before, but Simone is somebody that I think about often in this conversation. You know, she was the youngest press secretary to ever this for a viable presidential candidate.
Yeah.
All of the messaging that really rallied millions of people around this country to seek a different government through the campaign of Bernie Sanders, Simone led that, right? So what would it mean if we not only had 20 more Kamala Harrises, right, and 50 more Stacey Abrams, right, and like 75 more Nikita Olivers? What would it also mean to have 25 more Simone Sanders,
Absolutely.
Right? And I just think that that is what, that is the opportunity that sits before us. And that is why I'm so excited about Rise to Run, right? Because it's an organization that doesn't see this as a problem, that's, but rather sees this as an opportunity.
Right.
Yeah. And kind of along a similar vein, you created the hashtag Black Women at Work hashtag. And that was after April Ryan and Maxine Waters were disrespected by white men, of course. And we're seeing that continue to play out publicly whenever Kamala Harris tries to ask a question, like, you know, in a congressional hearing.
Like, heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid a former prosecutor do her fucking job. So
in a room full of lawyers, by the way. Though her questioning process is just so totally
out of this world. Like,
that's right.
It's too fast for the attorney general. Yeah. Makes him nervous. So what are some of the more egregious examples of this for you personally in your professional life? And maybe some insidious ones, too, because there's a lot of ones that are sort of subtle.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. But the subtle ones. And, you know, it's interesting because the subtle ones make you feel crazy. Right. The subtle ones are the, that's what we mean when we talk about microaggressions. Right. Mm-hmm. That they are aggressive, but that they're so subtle that you can almost miss them. And you go, is that because wait a minute, did I hear that right? You ask somebody else and you're like, did you hear that? And depending on their identity, they may or may not have these moments. I remember one time sitting with a donor who kept telling me how beautiful I was. And I'm like, well, I know, but that's not what we're here talking about, right? Like, we are talking about young people and social change and like how to make this the city that we both believe it can be. And I was with a colleague who's also a white man. So I was, both of the people at the table were white men. And when it was over, I said to him, I was like, we were walking out. I was like, can you believe that? And this was maybe my first or second month on the job, right? So I'm still getting my footing. I'm still having all the doubts that women have all the time, right? About like, I'm not ready for this. I'm not qualified. How do I have this conversation? And so I'm looking to my colleague for a level of reassurance and support. And I said, can you believe that? And he was like, oh, well, you need to use that. Use it to raise money.
What?
I'm so serious.
No.
And so when, as a woman, it stung, as a Black woman, it stung, because the conversation about Black women in particular is that we are both hypersexual, but that we also lack, that we lack in both intelligence and logic, right? And so when you put both of those together, I was walking out there, I was like, okay, let me take my car and drive away from both of you, because this is not how I want to conduct the rest of my day. And if all you see me as is an object, and then my colleague is telling me that I should be seen as that object in order to be successful, that was a really painful, and quite frankly, very infuriating. I think pretty obviously it's not how I've decided to conduct myself moving forward, but that was one pretty significant example of when being a woman at work and a Black woman at work it created a lot of pain. But you know, there are also a lot of moments of just like real triumph. I remember speaking to another Black woman who had been involved with our organization for a long time, but I was the first Black woman executive director that she had ever experienced.
Wow.
And I had lunch a couple of years after we met. We just, you know, stayed in touch. She was still working in schools and I was checking up on her, and she recounted to me the first outfit she ever saw me wear. And I was like, how do you, it was like an orange blazer and like a skirt with orange and brown and yellow in it or something. And she recounted it to me, and I was like, how do you remember that? And she was like, because all myself and all the other Black women that I was sitting next to talked about your outfit and remembered feeling more free to be ourselves because you chose yourself, right?
Yeah.
All of the moments that were frustrating and infuriating and painful, there were also moments like that where the decision to be authentically yourself, yes, it comes with punishment, but it also comes with real reward and triumph, not just for you, but for other women and other women of color. So I hold on to that one very dearly.
You almost give, when you put yourself out there, you give tacit permission for other people to do the same. And that is kind of a ripple effect. That's beautiful. That's really beautiful.
Well, people were that example for me. So I just potentially be that example for other people.
Yeah. Kind of on a different note, you tweeted after the Philando Castile verdict, quote, "Look, I just want to be happy and safe and black and all three at the same time." You've also been open about your struggles with depression. So for you, what does self-care look like in times of crisis, pain, and depression?
Yeah, so since you all can see me over Skype, I want to tell you I'm like, this is four or five shades darker than I normally am because I was just in Turks and Caicos for 5 days.
Yeah.
Like I saved my money because I really wanted to go and enjoy myself. And I turn off my phone for the most part. You know, I let my loved ones know that I'm arrived safely. I turn off my email notifications, right? So that was an act of self-care that I quite frankly hadn't had in a year's time. I hadn't been on a fully kind of turned off vacation in a while. You know, it was tough because I did, right on the tail end of that trip was when the officer that killed Philando Castile was acquitted. And so I still had to force myself to like experience joy, right? So it was like, we planned on going snorkeling. Part of me didn't want to get out of bed because of the news that I had just read, but I pushed myself to go snorkeling anyway. Saw a baby shark, right? It took my mind off some things for a little while. Self-care also just looks like reaching out to those folks who I know, A, understand, and B, know how to push me out of it, right? So it's my partner, Reggie. It is, you know, my really good friends, Antonio and Jovian and DeRay. Like there's a lot of love in this space. And so we can come together and, you know, I can send a text and say, look, here's what it is today. Here's how I'm feeling, and know that you understand. But I also know that in that conversation, you're going to make me laugh. Mm-hmm. And that kind of laughter lifts my spirit, right? So I also just really love TV. So when I find myself getting overwhelmed, I write down what I need to do. I take things one at a time. And when it's finished, I reward myself with binge watching something.
Yeah.
So I just finished Orange is the New Black. I love House of Cards. Queen Sugar is back on, which is one of my favorite shows. So I just finished watching that two-night premiere. And so, yeah, I let myself kind of disconnect when I need to. Remember that, you know, if I'm not here to fulfill my purpose, it doesn't get done, right? Just like if you're not here to fulfill yours, it doesn't get done. So taking care of myself is not just about, as Audre Lorde says, it's not about self-indulgence, it's about self-preservation, which is an act of political warfare. So a lot of it is just wanting to take care of myself for my own sanity, but and to make sure that I don't fall back into depression. But it's also so that I can be here to keep doing the work.
Yeah.
That's really well said.
Yeah, that is. I feel like it's definitely important, you know, to take, because you can't take care of other people if you're coming from a place like a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just not enough to go around.
Yeah.
So
it's like trying to drive 10 miles on an empty tank.
Right. You can't do it. Exactly. So, yeah, I think that's really well, great way to put it. So, kind of to close out, for every podcast, every episode we do a gratitude check. So to take stock of the good things going on, either personally or out in the greater world, amidst sort of these dark times. So what's something that you're especially grateful for right now?
Oh, gosh, so many things. I'm thankful for being five shades darker because I love my melanin and I love my melanin.
Love it.
I'm not thankful for what it took to wake a lot of us up, but I'm very glad and like really grateful that a lot of people are awake or woke, as we say, right? And are committed to staying awake, right? Are committed to learning more, doing more, engaging more, supporting more candidates, being a candidate themselves, marching more, reading more, going to more panels, learning more. Like, I just know that there was a time when I think as a populace, we were very comfortable. And deciding to intentionally make ourselves uncomfortable, I think will bring great reward for everybody, not just for the folks who are awake, right? But even the folks who are still asleep. I think that will bring great reward. I think it will bring more justice. I think it'll bring more equity. I think we'll push us closer and closer toward true liberation. And so I am, you know, not excited about all of the things that we're facing, but I am grateful for everyone who keeps putting their hand to the plow every day.
Yeah. It's interesting because one of my favorite quotes when you talk about getting uncomfortable is, I can't remember who this is attributed to, but it's progress never started at a comfortable place. Like there's always a tension. Like there's a reason why it's uncomfortable. It's because there's a way to go.
Yeah. I always tell my son, who's three, who doesn't get it, but whatever. I always say, you don't change because you're happy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's right. You have to be uncomfortable in order to push forward. Yeah. You know, Frederick Douglass said it like this. There, without struggle, there is no progress, right? So there's not going, you're not going to achieve the liberation, equity, justice that you want without toil, without difficulty.
Right.
And so, sometimes it's going to feel like we're taking 2 steps forward and 8,000 steps back. but every time people get up and keep fighting, it gives me inspiration to do the same. Yeah. So
that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, I think this is a great note to end on. Thank you to Brittany Packnett for joining us on Hellbent today. You can follow her on Twitter at Miss Pack Yeti. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Miss Pack Yeti.
My students named me that.
That's cute.
You can also follow Rise to Run on Twitter at Rise to Run. And you can also find and support Brittany's work at buildloveandpower.com, as well as listen to her on Pod Save the People, which is a great podcast. So thank you for joining us today, Brittany.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to listen in. Thanks for all you all do.
Okay, Devin, we just had a fantastic discussion with Brittany Packnett, who is brilliant and eloquent, and we were so excited to have her on the show. And I loved her gratitude check a lot.
Me too.
So let's get into our own. So what are you grateful for today?
Well, first off, I'm grateful that we got Brittany Packnett. We've had all these amazing women on our show.
Yes.
And then also Marcus Johnson.
Yes.
Who's not a woman, but he was also fantastic.
Yes.
And that's just been like such an amazing thing.
Yes.
But anyway, so first thing I am grateful for is Girl Scouts.
Yes. Oh,
I love the Girl Scouts.
Love them.
You know? So the Girl Scouts have partnered with Palo Alto Networks to create a series of 18 badges in cybersecurity.
Oh my gosh. Are they going to be the ones that save the day with all this Russian interference?
Yes. Yes. So the badges are designed and can be earned from kindergarten through 12th grade, which is amazing. So Girl Scouts of America CEO Sylvia Acevedo said, "It is our hope that our collaboration will serve to cultivate our troops' budding interest in cybersecurity by providing access to invaluable knowledge that may otherwise not be available to girls."
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so Girl Scouts have been offering STEM badges for years.
Oh, great.
Though this is the first series to focus on cybersecurity in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Girl Scouts has always sort of been at the forefront of giving this knowledge to young girls. And, you know, it's really sad because 74% of young girls express interest in STEM fields and computer science, but only 28% of computer science degrees are earned by women.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many studies that show that women and girls just get discouraged.
Exactly.
They're not as actively encouraged as boys and men are to pursue those fields. Or when they do pursue those fields, they run into all these barriers that men don't have to, and then that discourages them.
Yep.
But I love that this act of actively encouraging them at a young age.
Absolutely. It's great. I mean, Girl Scout badges are also amazing. I earned one in how to do my taxes and balance my checkbook when I was in the 10th grade. So, I mean, life skills, friends, life skills. Okay, so the next thing that I'm grateful for, that there was a poll put out by PRRI that found that fewer Americans across all religions support LGBTQ discrimination. That was confusing. Basically, there are less people who want to discriminate against the LGBTQIA community.
Yeah.
So over the past year, people who oppose religious discrimination are growing. The study that was unveiled on Wednesday, 61% of 40,000 people surveyed said that they oppose letting businesses refuse to serve LGBTQ people, but by citing religious beliefs. with just 30% in favor. This is a shift from just last year in 2015, in which 59% opposed and 35% were in favor.
Oh, wow.
So this is definitely a move.
So they're
in
like,
the right
no,
direction.
You gotta serve LGBTQIA people.
Right.
Like, just shut up.
Yeah, you can't use religion against it. Yeah. And also in 2015, 55% of Republicans surveyed supported religious discrimination. But in 2016, that number dropped to 49%.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, moving the needle.
Yeah, 6% in 1 year.
Exactly. And so the PRRI research director, Dan Cox, said in a press release, quote, at a time when Americans appear more divided than ever by partisanship and religion, there is increasing evidence that debates over LGBT rights have a short shelf life,
yep.
which is really just great. I mean, it's still a lot of dickwads that think it's okay to discriminate, but progress is progress, and I will take it.
Yep.
And then one last quick thing. California has crafted a $20 million grant to keep health clinics open.
Mm.
So in the face of possible deep cuts to healthcare providers.
Right.
California would like you to know that it is not here for this bullshit.
Ugh, I love our state sometimes so much.
So the treasurer's office posted an announcement on Friday, quote, the Community Clinic Lifeline Grant Program will help small or rural nonprofit clinics, including Planned Parenthood clinics, keep their doors open and provide critical services.
That's so great.
Yes.
And again, local, you know, municipalities and states, they're really where the resistance, I think the heart of the resistance is.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so doing things like this, I mean, $20 million, I mean, it's a lot of money, but in healthcare, it's not a lot, but it's something.
It is something.
It's something.
That's
so
really great.
Okay, Sarah, so what are you grateful for?
Yeah, so the first thing I'm grateful for is the man bun Ken meme.
Oh,
which
yes.
we've referenced a few times on the show. And if you don't know what it is, please Google it and you will laugh your ass off. And if you're on Twitter, you've probably seen
it all over the place. Yeah.
It's really the meme that keeps on giving. Or memeing. I don't know.
The meme that keeps on memeing.
Yeah. So on Tuesday, Mattel unveiled a whole new line of Ken dolls, and one in particular really captured the heart of the internet, which was Man Bun Ken.
Man Bun Ken.
It's so funny.
Did my college boyfriend have a man bun?
Yes.
Yes, he did.
He is a Man Bun Ken.
He is a Man Bun Ken.
Yeah, it was also like just super perfect for all the bad Ossoff takes that we had referenced earlier in the podcast.
It like came in a great moment.
It's so great. It really works for every dude bro situation you've ever encountered. There was a couple that like I just want to read aloud that just make me laugh. Quote, Man Bun Ken doll just interrupted me to tell me that Bernie would have won. The second one is, quote, check out my piece over at Salon about the menace of neoliberal identitarianism.
Oh, I don't want to read that.
And then when the one that I put out, the pay gap is actually a myth. There were so many good ones.
I know.
And, like, there was also, it just works for a lot of situations. Like, some were like, anyway, here's Wonderwall.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Some, like, douchey guy, like, playing guitar. Like.
I know. The one that I put out was, I just don't like Hillary, and this country really needs a third party, and that's why I voted for Gary Johnson.
Just, it's so great. I love it. Because now, anytime some mansplainy dude says something ridiculous, I can just quote him verbatim with Man Bun Ken beside it. Like, I just love it.
I know.
Works for every situation, especially politics. And, like, this meme will sustain me.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Like, I don't think I will ever get sick of Man Bun Ken.
Yeah, we touched on it before because I tried to apply it to Karl Rove. But I think you're right. I think it's more for, like, dude bros
it
on, like, the
really
left.
It really is. It really is.
You know, I was sort of thinking of it as just any sort of mansplainy bad take. But you're right. It doesn't really fit there.
It's really more for the progressives and the brocialists.
I like that.
It's
I
really
retract
great.
My Karl Rove man bun.
So that is something I will be grateful for while. The second thing I'm grateful for is the London School of Economics. So a study at LSE found that gender quotas increase the competence of organizations by leading to the displacement of mediocre men. Again, these two, like, in tandem are perfect.
Oh, seriously.
It just weeds out all the Man Bun Kens.
Yeah, right? Like, go, bye, boy, bye.
Boy, bye. So this research counters one of the key arguments that is often put forward against the introduction of minimum quotas to promote equality in the workplace, such that targets are meritocratic.
Meritocratic, thank you.
So, side note, meritocracy is a myth invented by white men.
That's not a thing.
It's not a thing.
It's not a thing.
It's only something that they say to make themselves feel better about their mediocrity. In male-dominated fields, especially in tech, you hear about how leaders, quote, like, sort of want to implement more inclusive hiring practices, but they just don't want to lower the bar, quote unquote.
Yeah, they're really super that high is fucking bars.
Again, meritocracy is a myth invented by white men, and that is a false dichotomy.
It is a false dichotomy.
And these researchers at LSE are like, yeah,
they fucking proved
this
it.
This is wrong. Because, yeah, they found that the reverse is true. Quotas can work to weed out incompetent men. So they studied a strict gender quota that was introduced by Sweden's Social Democratic Party for its candidates in 1993. At the time, some men were more critical than others, and the quota became known colloquially as the, quote, crisis of the mediocre man.
Oh,
which is the name of my memoir.
Yeah, right? subtitled Man Bun Ken.
Yeah. So they called it the crisis of the mediocre man because incompetent men had the most to fear from an influx of women into politics, which totally makes sense. And it actually reminds me of this video game study that was reported in the Washington Post recently. This was like last year or maybe 2 years ago. And it also happened to be one of my favorite newspaper headlines of all time.
Right.
It's called Men Who Harass Women Online Are Quite Literally Losers, New Study Finds.
Yep.
And this part in the study I want to read out loud. It says, quote, male players who were good at the game also tended to pay compliments to other male and female players. Some male players, however, the ones who were less skilled at the game and performing worse relative to their peers, made frequent nasty comments to the female gamers. In other words, sexist dudes are literally losers.
Literally losers. And that's the name of my memoir.
And it makes sense, because if you're confident in your own skills and what you bring to the table, you're not going to be threatened by equality. You're not going to be threatened by being... like shown the back door,
right?
Because you're confident,
exactly,
and you know what you bring to the table,
exactly.
So anyway, to bring it back to this London School of Economics study, they found that the average competence of male politicians increased most in the places where the quota had a larger impact. So
wow.
And they also said it can be applied to workplaces, not just politics. So on average, a 10 percentage point increase in female representation raised the proportion of competent men by 3 percentage points. So a rising tide of ladies lifts all male boats.
Just every lifting everyone.
And then it weeds out the man bun Kens.
The man bun Kens.
And then the researchers said, quote, mediocre leaders have a strong incentive to surround themselves with mediocre followers so as to bolster their chances of remaining in power. Quotas are indeed bad news for mediocre male leaders who tend to be forced out. And this
has Jason Chaffetz written all over it.
This is literally Dick Wadsby gone in action.
Yeah.
And this is the future that I want.
This is the future that liberal women want.
Okay, Devin, let's get into our Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters Award and badassery. So what has our favorite congresswoman, Maxine Waters, been up to this week?
Well, so Queen Maxine has been hard at work in her role on the Financial Services Committee.
Yep.
And so while the political landscape continues to look like it's ripped from a Tim Burton movie, Maxine Waters is focusing on her constituents' safety, quote, ranking member Maxine Waters highlights the need for bipartisan reauthorization of the National Flood Insurance Program.
Was that from the Financial Services
Committee? That was from the Financial Services Committee Twitter. It's really interesting because, again, this is not exactly like a sexy thing, like flood insurance. Mm-hmm. What? Mm-hmm. But I mean, these are the sort of bills that
really impact people's lives.
Exactly. Especially in times of crisis, like hurricane season's coming up.
Do we even have a FEMA director? May have nominated someone.
Yes. Yes. But, someone.
Yeah. It took him forever.
Yes. So there is definitely like a lot going on that isn't part of like the sexy politics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that she's on top of that. She's also going to give the keynote address at the St. Louis County NAACP dinner tonight.
Ooh.
So the organization put out a written statement and said, quote, Waters has been a tireless advocate throughout her career for people of color, women, children, and the poor.
Yes.
Which is true.
Absolutely true.
So, you know, she's just being a badass. And
yeah. We salute Congresswoman Waters. We feel privileged to live in the same city as her.
We do.
And yeah. So let's move on to the Maxine Waters Award in badassery. So who's our runner-up this week?
So our runner-up is an 18-year-old Girl Scout, which I think last week one of runner-ups was also an 18-year-old girl.
Oh.
A high school senior who did the abortion clinic safety map.
Oh, but was she a Girl Scout?
She was not a Girl Scout.
She was a teenager.
But she was a teenager. Yes, so I'm just saying all of these young women are making me feel like a fucking slacker.
Yeah, we gotta get on it.
So 18-year-old Girl Scout Cassandra Levesque dedicated her Girl Scout Gold Award project to changing laws that allow girls to marry under the age of 18.
Right. Child marriage laws.
Child marriage laws, basically. So most states allow marriage under the age of 18, although New York was just the first state to pass a bill.
Are they the first?
Yeah. Mm. They're the first to pass a bill raising the minimum age from 14 to 18.
Yeah. But you're saying with a parent's permission.
With a parent's permission, you can get married under the age of 18. Mm-hmm. So in Levesque's home state...
But that's not in New York. Or is it in New York?
Well, in New York, you can still... At 17, I believe you can still get married with a judge's permission.
With the judge's permission.
Right.
Gotcha.
So advocates feel like it doesn't really go far enough in some ways.
Gotcha.
But in most states, you can get married.
Yeah.
So in mm-hmm. Levesque's home state of New Hampshire, 13-year-old girls and 14-year-old boys are allowed to wed with the parents' permission.
Oof.
So while the rate of child marriages in the U.S. is much smaller than other countries, so just 58,000 marriages involving children between the ages of 15 and 17 were reported in 2014, the fact that these laws are on the books endangers children, particularly young girls.
Right.
And this is in contrast to Niger, which has the highest rate of child marriage, where 75% of girls under 18 are married.
Wow.
But Levesque contacted her local representative, Jackie Silly, to craft a bill that would ban marriages involving children under the age of 18.
Mm.
So the bill ultimately failed in committee. But Levesque plans to keep fighting. She has to wait 2 years to bring the subject up again. But
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But she and Silly plan to do so.
That's
awesome.
They
plan to keep fighting and working together on this.
Yeah, that's an issue I feel like that has flown below the radar.
Yes.
And like you said, New York raised the minimum age from 14 to 18.
Literally yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So
literally
yesterday. Yeah, and they're the first state to do so.
Wow, I didn't know that they were the first.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into our winner. And
yes.
We're going to award it to Mr. Beyonce.
Mr.
Himself,
Beyonce.
Jay-Z.
Yeah.
So for Father's Day, he took on the exploitative bail system.
Yes.
So it kind of harkens back to the Mother's Day initiative.
Right.
That Mother's Day action to get black women being held in prison out on bail. So they raised money for their bails because a lot of women can't afford it, especially women of color.
Right. And Jay-Z did reference that in his article.
He did reference. He said, quote, "Millions of people are separated from their families for months at a time, not because they are convicted of committing a crime, but because they're accused of committing a crime."
Yeah. So 400,000 people on any given day are in jail because they can't afford to pay bail.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. That's the only reason
they're
in jail.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah. And Jay-Z refers to this as pre-incarceration, and it disproportionately affects black and brown people.
Mm-hmm.
One in nine black children have one incarcerated parent.
Wow. Yeah. So it's a big problem.
It's a big problem.
And so it's great to see people like Jay-Z tackle it.
Yes.
The bail industry itself is extremely exploitative,
mm-hmm.
And $9 billion a year is wasted incarcerating people who have not yet been convicted of a crime. Bail bond companies and insurance companies profit off of families who are often forced to take on debt to bail out loved ones, assuming that bail is even an attainable goal for the family.
Yeah.
And then Jay-Z said, quote, "This Father's Day, I'm supporting those same organizations to bail out fathers who can't afford the due process our democracy promises. As a father with a growing family, it's the least I can do, but philanthropy is not a long-term fix. We have to get rid of these inhumane practices altogether," which I think is a really important point.
Yes.
Like, this, it's great that someone like Jay-Z and those other groups for Mother's
right.
Day were stepping up, but this is fixing a symptom, not
right.
a root cause.
Exactly.
And we need policies that address this.
And get in there and get rid of this extremely unfair and exploitative system.
Okay, Devin, so let's get into some action items. So stuff you can do after you listen to the show.
All right. So first off, if you remember on Patreon, we talked about a story of Nabra Hassanan. She was a 17-year-old girl who was found murdered after she went missing from her mosque late Sunday morning. The case appears to be a hate crime.
Although it sounds like they're not pursuing it as such.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, in reality, it has
is.
To be.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a fund sponsored by her mosque, Adams, at launchgood.com/project/4_Nabra. We'll have a link on our show notes. It says, quote, "The funds are being collected by Adams Center, the community where Nabra is from, and will be provided to the family upon completion of the campaign. Imam Magad, the leader of the Adams, is working closely with the family during their time of need.
Nabra leaves behind three younger siblings and a grieving family.
Yeah, so definitely a good thing to donate to.
Yes.
The second thing, we're going to keep hammering this over the head, but healthcare, motherfucking healthcare.
Fucking healthcare.
So not to sound like a broken record, but don't stop pushing your senators on healthcare. You know, as we talked about earlier in the show, the draft of the bill just got released, and it's just as bad. It's just as bad as you thought it would be. So again, for those with Republican reps, just keep pushing them, keep talking to them, keep flooding their phone lines, and don't relent. For those of us with Democratic senators, like Devin and I, ask that they withhold consent and filibuster by amendment.
By amendment, right.
The
Votorama.
Votorama, exactly. It's a great name. Republicans want to push this thing before July 4th. That's what's been reported.
Right.
They don't want to face their constituents. They know it's super unpopular. They just want to do it.
Right.
So don't make them easy. Don't make it easy for them to do so.
Right.
Also, similarly, Planned Parenthood has set up an Adopt-A-State healthcare phone bank to contact members in Nevada to call Senator Heller. So if you remember, we talked about him. He expressed serious concerns, and he's for re-election in 2018. So you can call people in Nevada to remind him to, like, fucking vote no on this shit. So we'll link to that in our show notes. It's kind of a long, complicated link.
Yes, yes. So, and then the last thing is rstates.org.
Yeah,
so
we plug this tool a lot. It's all so the time. Great.
It's so great. So Kamala Harris, she's collaborated with Capitol Hill colleagues with a bill to address voter suppression. Quote, the right to vote is not a partisan issue. Proud to join colleagues in introducing the Voting Rights Advancement Act. Hashtag restore the vote.
So that's what she tweeted.
Right.
And you might see hashtag restore the vote. It's trending today. And you also might remember that the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013 by a 5-4 decision. And at the time, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg warned that getting rid of a key measure there was like, quote, throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet.
Right.
And so, yeah, we saw the effects of, you know, the first presidential election without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. We saw that very well in 2016.
Yep.
And as Sarah Kendzior has said, like, it doesn't matter about, you know, you're a candidate or a message if not everyone has the right to vote.
Exactly.
Like, this is so important. This is an issue that Democrats should especially be focused on.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Sam Levine, who's a politics editor at HuffPost, he had tweeted today that Nancy Pelosi said that when Democrats win the House,
I like the
confidence.
Yep.
They will introduce two voting rights bills on the first day.
Yeah. And then Ari Berman quote tweeted that and said, if Dems took back Congress, they could immediately pass legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act. And it's a major motivation for 2018.
Major motivation.
Major motivation.
So, but as we know, we have a fucking monster.
In the meantime.
At the helm of the presidency. So in the meantime, we would urge you to focus your efforts locally at the state level. And that's why we are plugging rstates.org again. So 20 states are considering legislation to restrict voting rights, while 32 states are considering legislation to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
So 20 plus 32... That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Add to 50.
Well,
then maybe
there are states that probably are introducing both bills.
Oh, that's
to
true.
See what happens.
Sorry, my lady brain short circuited there. So anyway, use that tool, rstates.org, to look up legislation that is being discussed in your area, and call your state reps to let them know that it's not okay to suppress the vote and to push them in a positive direction.
Yeah.
Or push them away from a negative direction.
Your state reps love to hear from you.
They don't often hear
from
you.
They get super bored.
I'm calling Ben Allen like times a week. I'm like, what's up?
What's up, Benny boy? No, but it's seriously, rstates.org is a great tool.
Really great tool. And it's not just voting rights. They have other issues where you can look up bills.
So anything that you're interested in.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, Devin. Well, I think that was quite another packed show.
Quite an episode. Always. Such a great interview.
With Brittany Packnett. Yeah, we are obsessed with her, and we were so happy we got to talk to her today. But we will be back next Monday.
For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we've discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. You can follow Devin on Twitter at DevinHandy, and you can follow Sarah on Twitter at Sarah Lerner.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/HellbentPodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. And there are lots of other fun rewards for higher levels of patronage, including a monthly Skype session with Devin and Sarah.
And for that one, drinking is optional.
Optional.
Quote, quote unquote. Quote. Thank you.